Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And this is a very adventurous time of the year, right?
It is. Well, we're going on an adventure.
Yeah.
There's an adventure going on in a country a hemisphere away.
Yes.
Just now. Because the first ever version of the Latin American Best 50 Restaurants He's about to happen next week.
In Lima, Peru.
In Lima, Peru, yeah. Remarkable.
And I think to understand a little bit of the background in that, we have to understand that Lima, first of all, is the gastronomic center of Peru, and Peruvian cuisine is the hot up-and-coming cuisine. And it's varied. It differs from region to region to region. It has so many influences in it, including Japanese, Chinese fusions, Spanish. It's very exciting what's going on there.
Yeah, and the neat part about it is we actually already know two people who have won.
Well, they do that. They announce in advance of the actual. I might say that the way they get to this the selection is that members of this particular group vote. And it's pretty much a peer kind of a vote. But they do certain awards in advance, one of them being the Lifetime Achievement Award. And last spring for the world was the
was Alain Ducasse.
And for Latin America, it's Gaston Acurio, who's...
I have a feeling that the contest might be who has the most restaurants.
Well, he has certainly a lot of restaurants.
Because they both have plenty of them. I think Gaston, he and his wife Astrid have three or four restaurants in Lima alone, and restaurants all around the world. And then they have a prize, which was won by Elena Arzak, at the top 50 for the world in London, and the Veuve Clicquot best female chef in Latin America is?
Well, it's Helene Rizzo, who has a restaurant in Sao Paulo called Mani.
Mani. And she works with her husband.
Yes.
And if you want a little bit of intriguing gossip, I guess, she met her husband at the now number one restaurant in the world.
Yes, which is
on Roca in Gerona, Spain. So the world moves in very small circles.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's controversial whether or not you should have a best female chef, but I mean, I think that these ladies all deserve this.
I think the funny thing is that they announce them in advance.
Yeah,
I don't understand that. There's really no surprise.
Anyhow, there's still going to be lots of surprises.
I'm sure it's going to be a great party. And a couple of days after that, the mother and father of all Latin American food festivals,
Nestora,
is set to take place in Lima, Peru as well, and there's going to be a gastronomical congress. I don't know whether it's part of the same program or whether it's just happening at the same time, and some of the world's great chefs are gathering
we've done prior to this interviews with Alex Atala through the Cook It Raw.
We met him at the top 50.
And he's number six in the world. And he deals with all the Amazon food. He has a new cookbook coming out. That's the other thing. Everybody's coming out with cookbooks. This is a very exciting time of the year. Anyhow, what about our regular guest for this program?
Yeah, if we're not thinking Peru, what are we thinking about?
Well,
today?
The first up we have. People who followed the show will be interested in this interview, and it's Tremé,
right,
which is it's set in New Orleans.
And if you like, it's a book companion to the very well loved series about New Orleans post Hurricane Katrina, and one of the screenwriters for the show,
Lolis Eric Ellie, what a name!
And
actually
created a cookbook around the theme of the characters in the story and the kinds of restaurants they ate in, the kinds of chefs they knew, and the kinds of food that they liked to eat. So it's a rather fascinating intersection of a cookbook and a hit HBO series.
Well, I'm about to learn a lot, and just reading the recipes in this cookbook based on Tremé, the HBO series, it's going to make me fat. We're talking to Lois Eric Ely, who is a writer, who also, he's been writing for nearly 20 years, you said, about the food in New Orleans. And also, you were a writer on the show. Give us some details about the show, just so everybody's up to speed.
Well, I tell you, David Simon and Eric Overmyer, the creators of the show, are longtime fans of New Orleans music, particularly New Orleans R&B from the 1950s and 60s. So they had this idea that they wanted to do a show about New Orleans and New Orleans music. But, of course, that's kind of a vague idea for a show. But then Hurricane Katrina hits, the federal levee system fails, and suddenly New Orleans had an urgency, and they were able to sell this idea for a show to HBO. And at least two things going on in that show that you've never seen on television done in the same way before. One of them is that we have live music performances, several of them each time in the show. And then we also have a professional chef as a main character. We get to go through the kitchens with her and all the trials and tribulations of owning a restaurant. And what I've heard from chef friends of mine is that it's the most realistic portrayal on a TV drama before.
Well, you have good people advising. You have Tony Bourdain is helping with that, isn't he?
Yeah, and Tony's been great because, as you know, Tony is well aware of the underside of the kitchen business. So part of what happens is she has some kinds of trials and tribulations that the rest of us writers would not have even known to invent. But Tony's been there. He's done that. He's talked to chefs and been a chef.
Uh-huh. And, you know, you have some of the characters in this book are real-life people. Some of them are made-up characters altogether, right? But they appear on the show. They're part of the show.
Right. Well, our main characters are all made-up characters, but they're, for the most part, based on real people that we know in New Orleans, and so we draw on reality a great deal.
Well, you have a whole bunch of stuff to draw on if you're talking about characters in New Orleans.
Well, you know, so much of what this show is about is trying to be kind of an insider's view of New Orleans, meaning what you will have is tourists come there and they see a bunch of stuff in the French Quarter, they see a bunch of stuff at Carnival, and they think New Orleans is totally weird. Our attitude is, if you looked not at the most weird stuff, but if you look more closely at everyday life in New Orleans, it's far more interesting than what most Hollywood movies make up about the city.
This is true. Absolutely. Now here you have tea smothered okra. Is that T. Brennan?
No. That is from Wendell Pierce, who is one of the stars of our show. That's his favorite recipe. And so that comes from his mother. And one thing we often do when we're talking about our aunts is we call them T, you know, like T. Mary or T. Joan or whatever her name might be. Well, his mother is known by all of his cousins as T. And so that became the name of the recipe in the book.
Here's Grandma Besh's braised rabbit with cavatelli. You have recipes in this book from some of the most major chefs in New Orleans, as well as the most major chefs in New York, as a cookbook. I mean, who is this written for? Is it written as a fan book, or is it written as a cookbook? Is it written as both?
It's really to be both. It's a fan book in part because you get a background on our characters that you won't get on the show. Every character has a chapter in this book that starts with a sort of food autobiography from them, with them talking about their favorite dishes and their favorite restaurants. But my attitude is that long before I was a television writer, I was a food writer and a New Orleanian. And I want a book that if you were sitting in the bookstore trying to figure out which one New Orleans cookbook you'd buy, this would be a candidate. We have histories of various New Orleans dishes like the bread pudding in New Orleans and kalai and other dishes from New Orleans. We also have what is really a range of dishes that tells you about New Orleans food today, the stuff that your mother and grandmother and great-grandmother would have fixed. We also have recipes from chefs like Greg Saunier and Alain Shaya and Donald Link and John Besh, people who are cooking today and who are taking the tradition of New Orleans food and moving it forward.
Yeah, I love
okay,
all
yeah,
these shows.
Okay, yeah, you caught on to that right away. There is this exciting new generation of people who are, they're not reinterpreting, but they're evolving in a way that New Orleans cuisine hadn't done for quite a long time, I think.
Exactly. I mean, we have an interesting situation. If we changed nothing about New Orleans cuisine, people would still come here from around the world and really have a good time. But as a chef, particularly as a young chef, you don't want your reputation to be based on cooking 1,000-year-old recipes. So we have a kind of dialogue going on between the tradition and modernity. And it helps also that around the country people are interested in regional cuisine. So these guys don't have to cook like the folks in New York to make their own personal statement. What they're figuring out is how to make a personal statement through the lens of our recipes, our history, and our products.
Now, there's such a mix in New Orleans to draw on. I mean, I remember being so surprised reading John Besh's book called My New Orleans.
Right.
About the huge Sicilian settlement, Vietnamese. I mean, who would have thought all mixed together?
Well, people think that New Orleans food is all quote-unquote French. That's never been the case. It's at least as much Senegalese and Congolese as it is French.
That's interesting.
But additionally, we had Germans and Italians who were crucial parts, particularly in the sausage-making tradition when you talk about the Germans. That's crucial here and crucial in rural areas as well. But the two interesting things happening now that I think are worth keeping your eye on. One, the Vietnamese population has become so crucial a part of our city and our food scene that you find Vietnamese-inspired dishes even on menus like John Besh's. And obviously, he's not, you know, that's not an Asian or an Asian fusion restaurant. That's a Creole restaurant.
Are there
but we also have immigrants coming from Latin America.
Uh-huh. I mean, are there Vietnamese recipes in here? I remember that place called
Yeah, well, one of our characters ends up falling in love with a Vietnamese woman. And so we have a couple of Vietnamese recipes in his chapter that are sort of a tribute to their relationship and his experience there.
Wow. I mean, you have a complicated existence keeping what's current and real straight and also developing plots and fictional scenes. I mean, isn't that confusing?
Well, what makes it easy and helpful is that by writing in the voice of these various characters, I'm able to give voice to some of the opinions that I've heard chefs and cooks and family members say about New Orleans food over the years. So, for example, when I think about Big Chief Lambreau, who has a chapter in the book, I think about my own family and my grandparents who came from Maringouin, Louisiana. So a lot of what he says reflects that move of people from western rural Louisiana to New Orleans. We talk about folks like LaDonna, who owns a bar in the book. I think about my uncle, who also owned a bar, and he talked about what made him want to own it was this guy who had a bar in the neighborhood where he's growing up. So having those fictional characters allows me to take bits and pieces of my own autobiography and experience and put it in their mouths. So it can be confusing and daunting, but having written on the show for 3 years, that's sort of second nature to us.
Right.
Had you actually been a screenwriter before?
No, I had done a documentary film called Faubourg Tremé, and that was about the rebuilding of New Orleans after the storm, but more importantly, about the history of the civil rights movement in New Orleans in the 1800s. And it's a history that most people don't know much about, including New Orleanians.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, so I had done documentary screenwriting, but never done television writing.
It's interesting. Anne's pointing out to me a page of one of the more fascinating characters.
Yeah, we love
in New Orleans cooking is Joanne Clevenger from Upper Line. What an amazing character!
Well, she makes an appearance in the first season of the show.
Oh, she does.
Again,
how wonderful!
The third season.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Again, our characters go to real New Orleans restaurants, and most of the time, instead of just pretending that it's some generic restaurant, we're only there for our characters to have a conversation. Usually we have the chef or the owner come out and at least say something to our characters to make clear that our characters are in something of a real world. And Joanne is just such a classic New Orleanian.
Isn't she really?
What other restaurant do you know of that give you suggestions of other restaurants and other places to go in their restaurant?
She did that for us, actually.
She's absolutely amazing. I remember the first time we went there, we were actually on our way to dinner at a place which sadly is now closed, which was owned by a guy called Jason McDonald. We heard about Upperline and we decided we absolutely had to go there. So we got there at 5 o'clock and Joanne and her husband was also there. He's such a quiet character.
Right.
So she said, well, you have to have a bite to eat as well as a drink. Well, we waddled out of there at 7 o'clock.
And then had a whole tasting menu.
Yeah, we still had dinner ahead of us.
God. Yeah. Now, let's tell everybody who's missed the program or wants to find out, because you're on a different schedule right now, what are the details? It's HBO, right?
Right.
When is it?
And we will be returning to air on December 1st.
That's late.
So that will be the last season of the show. We have 5 episodes left to air.
I see. And it's, I guess the times, it would vary according to the different time zones when. So, but just look it up in your...
But it's Sunday night, right?
Right, right.
Now, are those shows done already?
Well, those shows have been done and they're in the can. We're just waiting for them to air.
Right.
Now, for anyone who has not seen the show yet, you can still buy the DVDs. Or if you have HBO, you can watch it on HBO Go.
Right, so there's still time for us to catch up.
Indeed, indeed.
And we certainly will. Now here, we're going to put you on the spot here. We'll let you do 3. But 3, your favorite restaurants in New Orleans.
That's really impossible.
You could have 300, but you're only allowed 3.
That's mean.
Oh, no.
That's mean, yeah.
Well, I tell you what, I'll give you 3 to get started. How about that?
All right.
How about Alon Shire, Domenica?
Yeah.
John Bashett, Restaurant August?
Of course.
And what would be our third one would be really hard.
Cushon.
Oh, yes.
Cushon.
Yeah.
There's also Dookie Chase, which is another classic.
We interviewed her. She was the first person we interviewed after the...
After Katrina.
After Katrina. Mm-hmm. Everybody really came to her.
Yeah,
Donald,
Donald Link would have to be in there, too.
Oh, Donald
yeah,
Link is fabulous.
I love Herb Saint.
Yeah.
We went to Cushon. We interviewed him at Cushon the last time we were in New Orleans.
Okay.
And he said, you know what? He said, we have a better charcuterie program this week at Herbside. You got to come there tomorrow.
But that's interesting because more and more chefs doing their own charcuterie now.
Yes.
And I'll be honest, at first I was like, y'all should just buy this. Most of these people are not doing a good job. Cochon's charcuterie now is fabulous.
Oh, it's
as
wonderful.
As is a launch eyes program at Domenica. I think American chefs are slowly but surely learning how to do it well.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
And I could start breakfast with it. And
yeah,
lunch. And lunch and dinner.
Well, listen. Are you on a book tour? Because you're someplace funny.
Exactly. I am in Wilmington, North Carolina now. The Cameron Museum here has an exhibit of Treme costumes.
Really?
That our costume designer, Alonzo Wilson, created. Then I'm heading to Poole's Diner up in Raleigh, North Carolina, going to Crook's Corner in Chapel Hill, going to Meridian Restaurant in Winston-Salem, and then going to a bookstore in Asheville, Malaprop's Books.
Uh-huh. And tell me this, do you have a segment starring Alan Richmond?
Indeed we do. In fact, that was the episode that I wrote in the second season. As you know, he wrote an article that pissed everyone in New Orleans off.
It pissed everybody in the United States off.
Yeah.
I thought he was definitely losing it.
Yeah, but
I tell you, though, he was gracious enough to appear on the show.
I do remember.
And as you can imagine, we make some fun of him and have some fun at his expense. But the good thing about it was him agreeing to be on the show us writing that segment was a way of everyone saying, okay, let's move forward from this, you know?
That's great.
It's wonderful. Well, it's
you're making me homesick.
Yeah, our viewing habits are going to catch up with your program, I feel sure. and the stories and recipes in your restaurant. We already read a lot of those, and they're fascinating. So whether you're a New Orleans fan or a Treme fan or just a food fan, this is one that ought to be on your bookshelf. And we thank you so much, Lilith, for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, too. I really appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And we'll be back with another interesting interview right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And this next interview is very interesting. Is it? To me, the title of the book written by this author is a little misleading.
Yeah, it's called "Eating on the Wild Side."
Sounded like it might be more like Treme than we thought.
It's really about our history of how we've bred out nutrition, actually bred it out of the foods we eat, and anybody will be startled, I think, just about anybody, to find out how much you don't know about foods.
And what you should know if you want to be considerably healthier. So here's Joe Robinson, who spent 10 years working on this, so pay attention.
Joe Robinson, who is a food activist and a health writer, has stirred up an amazing amount of excitement. I don't know, Joe, do we call it excitement? You're excited because you hit home runs with this book called Eating on the Wild Side, a radical new way to select and prepare foods to reclaim the nutrients and flavor we've lost.
And that's just on the cover. That's not even chapter one.
As I said to Joe in our pre-interview discussion, I thought I knew a lot about food until I picked up this book. And I'm startled. I turn a page and there's something new that I just didn't. In fact, not only did I not know about it, I had the wrong idea about it. How about starting with, you set out to do, the premise of this book, and you started out to do three things, and what are they?
I wanted to know, what's the difference between the food that we ate, our natural human diet, which was wild plants and game, what are the nutritional differences between that diet, which we had for most of our evolution, and what's in our supermarket today? Now, I had a hypothesis that we've probably been breeding nutrition out of our food.
Well, you can taste that. I mean, you can taste it.
And the taste. Absolutely. Yeah. And what I was startled to see is that we started breeding the nutrition out 10,000 years ago, not the last 50 or 100 years. We have to go back 400 generations to have food that's the most wholesome for us. And that the second thing that I've learned is that even though we've been breeding nutrients out for that very long time, there are varieties of fruits and vegetables right now that we can get in the supermarket and the farmers markets and seed catalogs that come close to the nutrition of wild plants. We just haven't known which ones they are. And the third area that I've researched is, what can we do once we've identified these really wholesome, great-tasting fruits and vegetables in the kitchen and how we store them, how we cook them, that preserves and even enhances the nutrients? So my goal is to find out what we lost, when we lost it, and what we can do now to bring back the kind of nutritional wealth that we had before we became farmers.
You have things like canned artichoke hearts are among the most nutritious vegetables in the supermarket.
There were many surprises along the way. We don't have enough good information about which varieties and which kinds of foods are good for us. So I was, I just read a total of over 6,000 studies trying to find out which ones in the store are good. And some big surprises, canned artichoke hearts. Well, and others are less of a surprise.
How would you find out the tearing romaine leaves the day before you eat it doubles its antioxidant content?
Yeah, this started when I realized the tremendous difference in health value between wild greens and, again, what's in the supermarket. Like, we think that spinach is a superfood, right? Well, compared with wild greens, like, for example, dandelions in your lawn, those greens have twice as much calcium, three times as much vitamin A, five times more vitamin K and E, and most important, eight times more antioxidants. And this is true of almost all the wild plants are much richer in antioxidants than what we eat today.
Did you, Robert, my husband is,
yes.
Did you hear what she said? And also, not only the dandelions that we pick out of our yard, but purslane. Tell us about purslane. He thinks they're weeds.
I think it's a weed.
It is a weed.
No, you're being unfair. I've eaten lots of wild dandelions that you've picked out of the garden.
But purslane,
I don't like the look of it, and it looks to me like a weed.
Well, it is a weed, in that we don't intentionally plant it, and it also it loves to go in newly disturbed areas, for example, our garden.
I love it.
And this time of year, it's pretty much more purslane than fruits and veggies in my if I didn't pick them. But anyway, so what's important about purslane is that it is very high in antioxidants, much higher than spinach again. But it is a rich source of omega-3 fatty acids, and these are the ones we know to be heart healthy and to help fight cancer. And most wild greens are also higher in omega-3s and antioxidants. But to get back to your lettuce ripping question, the lettuce, the least nutritious lettuce in the supermarket is iceberg lettuce.
Oh, sure.
So low in nutrients that basically it's just a watery crunch, which, you know, many people really enjoy. And romaine lettuce is slightly better, but not great. Well, some researchers, they decided to see if they could make those, like iceberg and romaine lettuce, more nutritious if they ripped it up and then refrigerated it overnight. Now, here was their thinking. When animals attack or insects attack a plant, plants fight back by producing this whole botanical arsenal of antioxidants to keep them at bay. So we know that if some animal comes through and browses on some greens, the next day those greens are going to produce more compounds to fight, you know, to prevent more predation. So the question is, if we rip our lettuce, does the lettuce think it's being eaten by an elk or a deer, and is it going to produce more antioxidants? And it does. In fact, four times more.
Not in the ground, still growing. It wouldn't have the same.
They're still living in a refrigerator. They're alive.
Oh, my God.
It's an amazingly simple trick.
I was right all
along. He always tells me that.
I always said vegetarians were lying when they said they were being kind to the environment. They're not being kind to the carrots and the onions.
They're eating them while they're still alive.
Awful.
What's the deal? I mean, why is it holier to be a vegan? Is it just that lettuce and carrots are dumber than animals?
Well, you know, they're lower on the evolutionary ladder, and you know, they don't scream, they don't have brown eyes. I mean, we have different standards based on how closely things resemble us. The closer they are to resembling us, the more we now, present day, object to eating them. But of course, that wasn't true as hunter gatherers. We, you know, as many as 50% of our calories came from wild game. And that's our native diet.
Yeah, the problem was trying to catch it, right? The problem was trying to catch up with it and kill it.
Yes, and we got wounded in the process. It was a very precarious life, but it was a more nutritious life.
Now you have such a thoroughgoing approach to this book. We ought to make sure we introduce people to what it is that's in chapters on different groups of foods. So why don't you go through the chapter on Brussels sprouts, for example, here's what you'll find.
Yeah, each chapter is a different kind of fruit or vegetable or family of fruit or vegetable, and so Brussels sprouts are in that kohl family, along with cabbage and arugula and a number of other crucifers. And why they're important for us is that they have more anti-cancer properties than almost any other vegetable. And in fact, research shows that if you eat 3 servings of these crucifers, especially Brussels sprouts and similar, like broccoli, plants a week, you get better cancer protection than if you were to eat 10 servings a day of other fruits and vegetables.
But go through, if you would, the different sections of that particular chapter.
Because
if people are going to use this as a reference work, then they need to understand what they're going to, in fact, they are going to find the reference work, and there are certain aspects of it that are going to be very important to them.
Yes, it's important to know which Of the crucifers are best for us, and so like red cabbage is a fabulous one. It's got 18 times more antioxidants than green cabbage. But there's a rule for all of these crucifers, and that is the longer they cook, the fewer nutrients they give you, and the more they have that cabbagey smell and a bitter taste. So you want to get them fresh, and you want to cook them very lightly.
But you've got this section in each of these. This is what I was referring to. Recommended varieties of, for example, I'm looking upside down at a page here, recommended varieties of broccoli, and whether you can find them in the supermarket or whether you likely can find them at farmers markets or can you get them in seed catalogs?
Right, right. And most of my information in the book is what you can find in the supermarket because that's where most people shop. And a broccoli, any variety you see in the supermarket is a good choice, but it's very important that it be fresh. Broccoli is what I call an eat-me-first vegetable. It loses its sweetness, natural sweetness, and its ability to protect you against cancer in a matter of days after harvest.
Oh, yeah. And the taste is so different. I mean, this crazy weather, we couldn't plant any this year, and it's just not the same. It's just going out in your backyard and cutting it.
That's the ideal. But, you know, for people who don't have backyards, thank goodness there's farmers markets.
Yes.
Yeah. So if you can get asparagus and broccoli, kale, and other crucifers right from a market farmer, it's going to be so much sweeter and better for you than what you can find in the supermarket.
You know, I'm surprised the kale has become such a superhero in the vegetable
isn't it?
Thing.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I was raised on kale, and I didn't even know it was unusual.
Oh, really? What part of the country are you from?
East Coast, but my background was Sicilian, so.
Well, you probably were raised on some wonderful fruits and vegetables.
Oh, yeah. And mainly an organic garden, too.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but
yeah. But, so, going back to what you knew as a child,
you know, we've interviewed people who were like apple breeders, and the guy who wrote the book on plum cots, and it's kind of it's evil how they're doing this breeding.
Oh, the apple story is just awful. Summarize the apple story. I mean, almost everything good about an apple has been removed.
Yeah. Exactly.
I was astonished. We humans settled on one species of apple, and we did it about 4,000 years ago. And it happened to be the biggest and the sweetest and the lowest in nutrition of almost all of the 35 species of apple. But we didn't stop there. Since we found that species, we began breeding it to make things even sweeter and milder tasting. And so today we have fruits, apples in the supermarket that are so high in sugar and low in antioxidants, and I'm talking about the Golden Delicious, for example.
Yeah, oh, it's awful, yeah, I know.
That an apple a day isn't going to keep the doctor away. In fact, in one study, these overweight men with a high risk for heart disease were given one Golden Delicious apple a day. Researchers thought they would end up, after 2 months, being healthier. The opposite was true. At the end of that study period, they had higher triglycerides and higher VLDL cholesterol, which is the kind that's most closely linked with heart attacks and stroke. So we took out the antioxidants and we added so much sugar that we took something which is excellent for us and have made it into something which is hazardous for our health.
Now, and in this case, in the case of apples, there's probably no way back, right?
No, that's not true at all.
Oh, it is true. Okay, go ahead.
You know, what we can do is find the varieties in the supermarket that are especially nutritious.
And so there are some.
Yeah, and so like a Granny Smith has 13 times more antioxidants to give you than a Ginger Gold or an L-Star. Or a Golden Delicious. So you need to know which ones to pick. So
What about the new breeds like that? What was that? Lady Lucy. What's it called? Lady Alice.
I don't know Lady Alice. I haven't seen nutritional information.
Well, it's crispy. What's that? Something crisp.
There's Crispin?
No,
something like a Golden Crisp or something like that. We can't remember.
There's Honey Crisp.
Honey Crisp.
I mean, that's one of the pieces.
Is Honey Crisp a good one or a bad one?
I assumed that it wasn't a good one because it's a big, pretty sweet apple.
Yeah.
But in fact, it's almost as good for you as the Granny Smith.
Oh, good, 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 good.
Okay. Yeah, that's so good, that's news. A good one. So
Lady Alice actually is a breed then between that one, the Honeycrisp, and something else.
Yes, I don't know which one you're talking about.
Well, that's good to know that they're breeding something that's not degrading the nutrient value, huh?
But they're not.
Yeah, and other
good
apples are the Fuji.
Oh, the Fujis are good. Okay.
The
good.
Red Delicious, the Jonathan, Melrose, Cortland. These aren't the most common ones, but you will find them in the grocery stores around the country.
Huh. So listeners, this is an important thing to recognize, that this book is a gold mine of information that will let you find out about which varieties of the crops you're interested in eating are the ones that are going to be better for you.
Let's talk a little bit about food preparation.
Yeah,
Found out that's just as important. Garlic, for example.
Yeah, I was just looking at that. That's amazing to me.
We've all been told that garlic is great for our health, and people have known that for thousands of years. There's an ancient Egyptian text that has a recipe for 12 different garlic preparations to fight all kinds of diseases. So we've known this for a long time. But we've only known since 2001, and here's something interesting, that this study was conducted in Iran, not this country. I find that over and over again, a lot of the research, which is most important, is not produced in the United States. But anyway, these researchers in Iran discovered that take a fresh garlic clove, and you slice it, press it, and put it immediately in hot oil, which many recipes call for, or you put it in a hot sauce or soup. You destroy allicin, which is the medicine in garlic, which fights cancer and cardiovascular disease. We've only known that since 2001. But these same researchers found that if you take that fresh clove and you chop it, mince it, slice it, and set it aside on your counter for just 10 minutes, the maximum amount of this allicin is produced. And then you can put it in the heat, and there's no you have all the health benefits possible. So my mantra is, and it's such a simple thing, is press your garlic and rest it for 10 minutes. And for me, this is second nature. I would no more put a clove of garlic in something hot than I'd put my finger in there.
That's funny.
You know, once you understand the importance of it and how easy it is, I find that you can just make these minor changes that have a big return in terms of better health.
But they need to actually know this stuff because it's not intuitive, to us. Our minds are different.
In fact, it's the opposite.
Counterintuitive.
It's actually the opposite because I know, for example, I have a chili recipe that I make that is, what's the guy's name? I always forget.
Rick Bayless.
Rick Bayless's recipe. And he calls for you to, you've got to throw the garlic into the really hot fat.
Yeah.
So he's dead wrong.
Well, it's understandable.
He's missing
out. This is a study that is recent, that wasn't published in this country, and people still wouldn't know about it unless I put it in my book.
Yeah.
I mean, we're so slow to take really practical information that are in these academic journals and make them available to the public. I think it's criminal.
Well, what we're not too slow about, in fact, I needed to ask you about this, is we get samples sent from every single new super fruit or whatever substance. And the latest being Moringa. You know that one?
Moringa?
Moringa.
Moringa, no.
It's a leaf.
It's a leaf. And it's supposed to be more powerful and healthful than anything else on the face of the planet.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of just many. What about all these berries that come out of China and South America? I mean, is there any validity to any of this stuff?
Sometimes yes and sometimes no. Sometimes it's a commercial operation.
That's what I think, yeah.
Yeah, they're almost pyramid scheme when you look at them. Some of these juices, for example, that you get this free, and then, you have to sell 50 cases of it, to get it free. That's why I'm focusing on things you can get in the grocery store that aren't necessarily expensive. So one of the most nutritious juices, believe it or not, is Welch's grape juice. And the brand matters.
Uh-huh. But that's sugar. I mean, it's really sugar.
It is, you certainly don't want any grape juice with sugar added to it.
Mm-hmm.
But, grapes are sweet, one of the reasons that we like them. So this 100% Welch's grape juice has been shown to reduce blood pressure, reduce inflammation, and to help older people with failing memories actually regain some cognition.
Boy, I better get some grape juice.
Yes, yes. I have some in my pantry. It's inexpensive. It's all American. And you don't have to get in a pyramid scheme to take advantage of it.
Oh, dear. Well, you know, that I could talk to you, Joe, can you just call me sometime and just chat?
Oh, I'd be happy to, yes.
I really would like to befriend you and share your knowledge, and I hope that all of our listeners will just get this book and learn something that you really never even thought you didn't know.
And Eating on the Wild Side the title's a little bit confusing. I think if we've done one important thing today, Joe Robinson, we have explained to people that the title isn't perhaps as clear as a description of what's in it.
Well, the subtitle is The Missing Link to Optimum Health.
And I actually titled it that deliberately. I'm talking about Eating on the Wild Side, not Eating Wild. I want people to find modern plants that approach the nutrition of wild plants without going into the woods to get them.
Well, I hope we don't have to wait 10 years for another great book.
Yeah, your book.
You might have to. I'm very serious about my research.
Well, you're soaring on the New York Times bestseller list, and so I wish you continuing success with your wonderful, informative book.
And you won't believe, probably, when we tell you that right after the break, we're going to have a whole segment about water. So, you got to be interested in that, right?
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We promised you a whole segment about water, but I bet you're not expecting what's going to come next from Martin Riesi, who's a German and one of the world's few water sommeliers.
Yeah, sommelier.
So you want to know more about that?
Would you pay $15 for a small bottle of water?
apparently many people do. Yeah, and apparently it must be pretty good stuff. And he makes it himself.
Here's
one that he sells for $15 that he makes himself. I'm not exactly sure how he makes it. I'm not sure I really want to find out. But he sells them for $15 a piece, so they must be pretty good. Anyway, here's the whole story.
We have a very interesting program ahead of us here with Martin Riesi, who is a German born and currently working in Los Angeles. Martin, you've gained a great deal of ink and air lately for initiating a water menu at the restaurant you work for. You are a water sommelier.
Correct.
I guess the first thing I want to find out is, what is a water sommelier?
Yeah, first of all, thank you so much to be on the show. I'm very honored, actually, to be with you in the program.
Great.
So a water sommelier, this is like a question what I'm getting asked every day, actually. So my history is like, I'm coming from Germany, I'm German born. I spent my whole life on water because I'm coming from the Danish border and we have the Baltic and the North Sea right in front of me. So therefore water was always an interesting topic for me even when I was a small child. So when we went on vacation with my parents, I always tried the tap water.
And really?
My parents always thought like, what's wrong with our son? Why is he always so thirsty? For me, it was not more the thirst. It was more like the taste. Because I realized as well that even tap water has different tastes. It depends where you're from. So
sometimes it's not very nice.
Correct. Here in Los Angeles, for example, it's not the best thing to drink, what I think, because there's so much chlorine in it. So in 2005, I started to work in a one-star Michelin restaurant. It's called The First Floor in the Hotel Palace in Berlin. And I started there my position as a general manager. And a customer came up to me and said, do you know what, Martin? I don't like the brand what you're serving. Do you have something else for me? And I was like reminding myself sadly to my childhood, and I was thinking, he's so right. Because water has different tastes. why we have like so many different wines, so many different spirits, amazing cocktail program, and so many different food items available, but we just have one water available. And there was some disconnection for me. So therefore, I came up with like a water menu in my old restaurant with 14 different mineral waters, and we realized that the demand was there from the customers, and they said, oh, you have this water, can I have that water? Or maybe you never know about this water, maybe you want to add this to the list as well. So we ended up to have 40 different mineral waters on the list.
Martin, hold on just a second. We're talking about water here. I'm being a little bit of a devil's advocate, if you like, here. There's a substantial difference between a red wine from Burgundy and a red wine from Bordeaux and a red wine from California. And a red wine from Australia. Now, the difference in flavor in waters is much smaller than that, surely.
It's much smaller, that's correct. But I'm happy you're bringing that up. It is exactly the same with water, what you just described with wine. It all depends where the water is coming from. So about terroir, what we always in the wine business are saying, it's exactly the same with water. And this is, for me, the most amazing thing, actually, because in the beginning, all bottled water, what we know in this planet, is actually rainwater. So the rainwater drops down to the ground. It goes to different like filtrations of natural filtrations of the grounds, and it takes through this filtration process different minerals with them as well. And therefore, a water tastes after the origin where it's coming from. And this is, for me, the most amazing thing. So a water, what I have on my menu, for example, it's the TDS levels, what we're always saying, what we can measure the taste of it. So TDS means total dissolved solid. So we're starting here with a TDS level of under 10 milligrams per liter. It's called Berg, the water, and it rises up to over 3,500. That water called Vichy Catalan, and it comes from hot springs from northern Barcelona. So there are huge taste differences, actually, and everybody who doesn't believe that, I'm more than happy to show them this here at Raisin's Dark Bar. I will show them two waters, and everybody, really everybody, is getting after that. Okay, water tastes really different.
Now, when they're drinking this, do you have special pairings with food as well as tastings, right?
So first, it's more like the approach of tasting. So what we're doing here at Raisin's Dark Bar, we wanted to give an option to our guests. Because what I said in the beginning, just one water brand, I think it's not okay anymore. And it's the same with like crafted beers, for example. It's the same movement. Like for 20 years ago, you just had like two brands, maybe very well known in America. Now you have so many amazing microbreweries, and they're doing such a great job to provide amazing beers. Then I think it will be the same with water. It's a healthy product, so we're starting with this one water, maybe for 10 years ago, everybody knows this, but more and more water will be added. And I even went to a grocery store already here on Fairfax, and they have 18 different mineral water brands that they're selling.
Is that
so
because
it's not
of you?
Just like, no, I don't think so. It's just like a normal thing, but in a restaurant scene, it's surprising you, obviously. And for me, it's kind of interesting because I think always in the restaurant, they should be the first one, and then the grocery stores are catching up to it. Here in California, obviously, it's the other way around. You've already been known for so many different waters, but nobody in the restaurant industry thought about the idea to came up with a water menu.
Now
so
you
we
have
are
you,
kind of the pioneers here.
You have your own brand, actually. Now tell us, how did you make your own brand of water? And it's called
90H2O.
Correct. It's called Beverly Hills 90H2O. So we're making a little bit fun of the zip code of Beverly Hills because the famous Beverly Hills zip code is obviously 90210.
Yeah.
And we thought H2O, the chemication formulation, would be then 90H2O. So we're tying this together somehow.
Very clever.
So a family in Beverly Hills, a family native family, came up to me for 1.5 year ago. The son is called John Gluck. He's the president of the company. And came up to me and said, Martin, we have an idea. We have a bottle, like the form of the bottle, and we have a name, Beverly Hills 90H2O. But we don't have the rest. I think, yeah, that's pretty unfortunate because for a water company, you should have a good water as well in your bottle. So therefore, we had an idea to create a water what fits perfectly for food pairing and wine pairing. So what we came up with, we found a spring in the Sierra Nevada mountains, so it's a mineral water spring already, and then I came up with a perfect formulation, what I believe in and what I think it's an amazing, great taste, what I think water should taste like. So we are adding natural minerals like magnesium, calcium, potassium, and silica in different amounts that we're coming up with an amazing taste. It's extremely refreshing. It's very smooth on the palate, but we have a very good amount of TDS level, 390, so it's a very more minerality than a lot of other waters what you maybe can buy in the grocery store. And I need that mineral content to pair perfectly to food and wine, because food and wine has mineral content as well, and I want to achieve the perfect pairing.
So now you actually, in addition to pairing the waters with food, these people who are drinking the waters also drink wine with their food.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm a huge fan of wine, and for me it's like when I'm going to a restaurant, the superstar is the food. This is for me always the superstar. Then the wine is coming, because he has to supplement the food and the wine. But I think there's a third angle, and we're always saying in Germany, everything what stands on three legs cannot fall down. And therefore, I think the third angle should be water, because water has a huge impact on food and wine as well.
That's a very clever expression. I'm surprised the English didn't pick it up. Whatever stands on three legs can't fall down. But here's to me an interesting thing about water, and it's I'll reveal our own preference when I do that. We have always thought that sparkling water was somehow much more refreshing than still water, and you've got waters of both kinds on your menu. What do you think about that?
So I wouldn't say it's more refreshing, because it really depends on the mineral content. Obviously, a water who has carbonation feels maybe a little bit more refreshing, but when you have a mineral water what has a good amount of TDS levels, let's say 390 or above, and it still has this refreshing notes as well. And this is then interesting. A lot of people thinking mineral water is similar to carbonated water, and that's not true. Carbonated water is water who's carbonated and can be mineral water, can be purified water, but mineral water always has mineral from themselves already in nature. And this is like the big difference there.
Now, you may run into a little bit of trouble with the echo, called the echo dominant clientele, because they disapprove of bottled water, period.
Oh, they do?
Yeah, it's not sustainable. I mean,
oh, I see. Yeah.
That's why they tell you to opt for tap water when you're in a restaurant.
But when you're going to a restaurant here at Raisin Starkbar, for example, actually it's a bad example, because Raisin Starkbar filters the tap water, so therefore you do not have this chlorine taste anymore, at least. But when you're going to like a normal restaurant, they maybe don't filter anything, you really have a beautiful maybe red or white wine in your glass, and then you're like drinking this chlorine taste water right next to it, and it really affects the wine taste, and it really affects your food taste as well.
Right.
So I'm a believer that bottled water has different taste. Therefore, what I see in the grocery store almost has the same TDS levels. Therefore, I think it's very important even when, and customers have other tastes, so I don't know, even saying it's my taste. People have different options, have different taste panels, so therefore, I think it's totally limited to bring bottled water into this country as well. I'm treating it the same like red wine. Nobody's asking about red wine or white wine, oh, the Bordeaux blend from Bordeaux, it's great. But nobody would say and came up with the idea, you should drink actually the Napa Valley Bordeaux blend, because it's not okay to bring a French product into the country. The same with clothes. Most of our clothes, what we're wearing here, comes from China. So to start now by water, this is not okay to bring it in. And the other product, it's totally okay. I don't get that, actually. So therefore, I believe that water has such a huge impact on taste and has a different taste. Therefore, it's totally fine for me, actually, to chip around the world.
Now, what are the most popular waters, generally, that on your menu? What would they be? Could you just tell us a little bit to contrast them, the differences between mm-hmm. them?
So we have like 20 different brands now on our menu from 10 different countries. And obviously, when I created that list, I wanted to bring in some unusual waters, like Iskilde, for example, from Denmark, or Vichy Catalan, what I said in the beginning, from Spain,
right.
Or Berg from Canada. But we have like common brands as well, like Pellegrino or Acqua Panna, Peye, Barua. Maybe not everybody knows it, but Barua is a great water from France as well.
Right.
Has like very, very tiny, smooth, amazing champagne bubbles, I would even say. So for me, it was important to bring this whole thing as an accessible point as well, to have different price points as well. And therefore, I'm very, very happy now with my menu that we have some brands, well, it's very well achieved and known in this country, and we can surprise as well customers with, like, some unknown brands.
Now, people don't balk at paying $15 for a bottle of water. Customers do not think it's okay to be paying $15 for a bottle of water. It's interesting, isn't it? On top of your wine now.
I wouldn't say, like, it's for me interesting, but I think there's a lot of people, and it's getting more and more getting interested into bottled water, and they're realizing that's a quality standard as well. It's the same, I would say, with Starbucks. For 20 years ago, people could not believe that they're charging $2 or $3 for a cup of coffee.
Right.
They were outrageous. But then Starbucks had to say, okay, listen, we have a quality product. We have to charge a little bit more for that because the small beans are coming from this point and this and this and this. So they had to, like, educate a little bit people. And I think it's exactly the same with water. A lot of people still think it's all the same, it's all tap, or it's all purified water. And no, our water list does not have purified waters on the list. So that purified means actually tap water filtered and bottled into plastic bottles,
right,
and then selling at the grocery store.
Supposedly tasteless, right?
Correct. We don't have that here on our list. We have mineral waters, high-quality mineral waters on our list. And people will pay for a little bit higher, maybe a little higher price, for a very good and healthy option. And this for me is important as well. I'm not selling here any unhealthy products. We're talking about a healthy product. What's very, very healthy for you. And I think that's very important as well.
Now, you are a certified water sommelier. First of all, who certifies water sommeliers? And next, how many other people are certified? Size organization is it?
So the whole idea about mineral water in Germany is totally different than here in the United States, or in Europe, I would say, in generally. Just in Germany, we have 580 different mineral water brands from Germany. We're not talking about Fiji, Foss, Badoa. We're adding them even on our 580 different bottled waters, what we're having in Germany. So therefore, the German Trade Association for Mineral Waters came up with the idea, we have so many different brands here in Germany, we need to educate people on this brand and which brands has which effect on your health, on your body, on your taste, on your experience in dining. So therefore, the German Trade Association came up with the idea, we should start a program to certify water sommelier. And they're doing this since 2010 now. I'm doing this since 2005. I helped them to evaluate this program as well. But obviously, I helped them so much that they said as well, Martin, because you helped us, you went through the whole process of programming as well, you will be a certified water sommelier as well. So since 2010, I have my certification as well for that.
Yeah.
And we're talking about, like, it's not that many. It's not like that we have suddenly, like, hundreds and hundreds of water sommeliers. But let's say it's 50 or 60 already in Germany. They're not maybe that known, that I'm known, because now I traveled all over the world as well already. And so in a lot of, like, different countries, I've been known as a water sommelier, especially now here in the United States, since, like, I would say 2 weeks, because we had a huge success suddenly with our water program since we launched that, and a lot of media attention came up to me.
Right.
And what's almost scares me, actually, because I'm a person who just, like, wanted to create an additional interesting concept for my guests. I never would imagine that it was, like, national news suddenly. But
yes,
it's good. I think we started to roll a stone here, that people are rethinking maybe the use of water as well, and this is for me important as well, especially here in Los Angeles. We are living in a desert, let's face it, and a lot of people really don't take care of the resources, especially water, and they think, ah, it's cheap, it's fine, we can use it so much we want. And a water menu actually is a great example for this as well, to maybe take this whole approach a little bit more seriously and say, hey, we have different mineral waters. Water is the number one element in our world. Without water, we never could survive on this planet. Maybe you should reconsider the use of water as well. And I think a water program, what we have in place right now, maybe still start to people think a little bit about that.
Well, this has certainly been interesting, Martin, and it's, again, the Rays and Stark is the restaurant where people could go to experience this water menu.
Yes.
And I'm sure we'll probably be seeing an expansion of the program, because if it's working there, other people are going to want to cash in on it.
Say to you what we will definitely do, because we are part of the Patina Restaurant Group, and then I had already a talk with Joachim Splichal, the owner and founder of the Patina Restaurant Group, who said, we will roll out our water program in all West Coast restaurants.
Okay.
So Raisin Stark Bar is the first one. Patina, our flagship, will have a similar menu to it, and then we will cutting it down. But we want to give options to the other restaurants as well, like four or five different interesting waters, that they can see the difference as well in all other restaurants.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank
Excited
you so much.
To be able to talk to somebody about it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Martin.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And listeners, that's all until next week. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.